Right now, somewhere in the world, there's a massive container ship moving millions of dollars of physical goods across an ocean.
Right.
And at the same time, a multinational corporation is issuing a new series of bonds. Or, hundreds of millions of morning coffee orders are being paid for with just a simple tap of a plastic card.
Yeah, the everyday mechanics of the economy.
Exactly. And for every single one of those actions, an invisible toll booth just quietly collected a fraction of a penny. There are no flashing screens on trading floors tracking this. There's no breathless news commentary about it. Just a silent, unstoppable architectural mechanism siphoning wealth from global commerce.
I mean, the contrast between that silent reality and, well, the theater of the financial markets is profound.
It really is.
The market is fundamentally designed to capture your attention. It prices assets based on visible noise, the grand narratives of software revolutions, or the speculative frenzy around the next semiconductor breakthrough.
Right, the collective hope of what might happen in the next 90 days.
Exactly. It is loud and it is entirely ephemeral.
Which brings us to the core of today's deep dive into an article from the Averaging Up collection. The mission here is to map out a specific type of permanent business, what the author refers to as the free surfer.
Right.
We want to explore how these invisible businesses function as an underlying architecture of capitalism, how they capture that toll at zero marginal cost, and, crucially, why the standard valuation models utilized by Wall Street analysts completely fail to measure them.
And to set the tone, the author anchors this entire framework with a quote from the philosopher Blaise Pascal. He said, all of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone.
That is such a striking way to put it.
It perfectly encapsulates the tension we are examining today. The visible market, the constant buying and selling based on quarterly narratives, represents that inability to sit quietly. But the invisible market, the infrastructure, well, that is the reward for profound patience.
And to be clear for you listening, these invisible businesses are not obscure speculative startups. We are talking about the very bedrock of the global economy. Payment rails processing trillions of dollars in daily volume.
Yes.
Credit rating agencies that evaluate and essentially authorize every major debt issuance on the planet. Or index providers that collect an embedded fee on, trillions of dollars sitting in passive retirement accounts.
Right, and the financial apparatus ignores them, not because they are insignificant, but because they lack a daily dramatic narrative. I mean, a payment network reliably processing 10 million transactions an hour is economically essential, but it does not make for a thrilling headline on financial television.
No, definitely not.
The visible market performs for an audience. The invisible market simply compounds in the background.
Okay, let's unpack this. I want to look closely at the mechanics of this compounding because the article introduces a structural concept called the dual duration architecture.
Right, the core mechanism.
It suggests that within these specific businesses, there are two distinct forces operating simultaneously. Force A is the short duration pull, the literal cash collected today. And force B is the long duration wave, representing structural long-term growth.
And in a standard a mechanical business, those two forces are fundamentally severed from one another.
How do you mean?
Well, the cash a company collects today is one discrete element, but the growth for tomorrow must be purchased entirely separately.
Okay, I have to push back here, or at least pose the question for the listener, because under normal business logic, doesn't growth always cost money?
That's the standard assumption, yes.
Right. If a company wants to increase its revenue, it has to hire a larger sales force, build a new manufacturing facility, acquire a competitor something. Even if I own a massive digital payment network and transaction volume doubles globally, I still have to build larger server farms, hire more cybersecurity experts, upgrade my code base. How can growth possibly be free?
Well, you are identifying the difference between maintenance capital and growth capital. And that is exactly where mechanical businesses fracture.
Okay.
When a traditional company builds a new factory or attempts to acquire a rival, it is deploying capital outside of its existing competitive advantage. That requires immense operational effort. It introduces severe execution risk. And frankly, the return on that newly invested capital is highly uncertain.
So they are stepping out of their safety zone to buy growth.
Precisely. The free surfer operates differently because the growth arrives entirely inside the existing advantage.
So the distinction is structural.
It is entirely structural. The article uses a great visual analogy, a lever operating on a fixed, unmoving fulcrum. The toll, which is the A, multiplies the ways, which is the B.
Right.
The payment network you mentioned might have slight incremental costs in data storage, sure, but its core infrastructure is already built and paid for. When global digital transaction volumes increase by 10%, the network does not need to build 10% more infrastructure to capture it. The revenue scales automatically because the business is deeply embedded in the flow of capital itself.
Mm-hmm. The margin simply expands mechanically. They're capturing the expansion of the broader global economy without deploying their own capital to generate that expansion. The toll intercepts the wave.
Exactly. The growth is not the result of brilliant, proactive managerial maneuvering each quarter. It is a geometric certainty dictated by the structure of the market.
The geometry of compounding. Now, the article breaks this permanent wave into three independent layers that stack at zero marginal costs.
Right. They happen simultaneously.
The first layer is real volume growth. More corporate bonds being issued, more physical cash moving to digital channels. That is a secular civilizational shift.
Yes.
The second layer is straightforward pricing power. The network or the rating agency adjusts its fees upward. And because they are essential infrastructure, the counterparty has no negotiating leverage. They simply pay the higher fee.
And what's fascinating here is the third layer. It's arguably the most profoundly misunderstood by the broader market.
Inflation pass-through.
Yes. Look at how these toll businesses interact with a rising price environment compared to traditional mechanical companies.
Well, mechanical businesses treat inflation as an absolute nightmare. If you are manufacturing physical goods, the cost of your raw materials spikes.
Logistics and shipping become significantly more expensive.
Right, and your labor force rightfully demands higher wages to meet their own rising costs of living. You have to fight a brutal war to pass those increased costs onto the consumer, and in almost every case, your profit margins shrink during that process.
It's a constant battle. But the free surfer operates on a strictly percentage-based toll. If the global price of goods rises by 10% due to inflation, the total dollar value of the transactions flowing through a payment rail naturally increases by that exact same 10%.
Oh, wow. So the toll simply takes its fixed fraction of a penny or its set percentage of that newly inflated, much higher number.
Exactly. The revenue increases automatically. They do not have to alter a single fee structure, hold a board meeting, or deploy any effort to capture it.
They absorb inflation at a 100% capture rate.
While their own fixed operational costs remain virtually flat, the macroeconomic inflation actually widens their internal profit margin.
So what does this all mean for traditional valuation? If this growth requires zero capital, and it perfectly captures both economic expansion and inflation indefinitely, standard valuation tools must be giving false ratings.
They absolutely are. Analysts rely on discounted cash flow, or DCF, models. Those spreadsheets are built on the assumption that a business operates in cycles, that growth eventually slows down, and that capital must be continually reinvested just to survive.
Standard mortal business metrics.
Right. The standard DCF spreadsheet is constructed to measure mortal mechanical businesses. But the free surfer's wave is structurally permanent. It is driven by forces like global financialization and the shift toward passive investing. These forces operate on civilizational timelines measured in decades, not 90-day earnings cycles.
It's like, think of a standard valuation model, like an equation designed to measure how far a car can drive on a single tank of gas. The formula factors in engine friction, tire wear, and eventually running out of fuel.
Right.
But a free surfer is essentially a vehicle rolling down an infinite frictionless hill. When you input infinite fuel and zero friction into the standard formula, the calculator breaks. It was never designed to measure infinity.
The mathematics of the DCF literally break down. Mm-hmm. Because when you evaluate a business where the growth costs absolutely nothing and the duration of that growth is structurally permanent, the denominator in the valuation equation begins to approach zero.
And in mathematics, as a denominator approaches zero, the resulting value approaches infinity.
Exactly.
That implies the traditional market mechanisms are systemically undervaluing these specific assets because they are applying the wrong measuring stick.
They are.
But before we assume every highly profitable technology company possesses this infinite duration, the article imposes severe boundaries. It outlines a strict hierarchy of advantage, differentiating the moats. Because not all competitive moats are created equal.
No, they are not. And the framework categorizes moats into a rigid hierarchy. And this hierarchy dictates the purity of the underlying growth.
Okay, walk us through that.
At the lowest tier is a contractual moat. Think of a pharmaceutical patent or a time-bound licensing agreement.
Temporary by design. The day the patent expires, the pricing power vanishes, and generic competition decimates the cash flow overnight.
Right. Moving one tier up is the behavioral moat. This relies on consumer habits, brand loyalty, or high switching costs.
Like a popular consumer electronics company.
Yes. It is durable, but it remains conditional. Even the strongest consumer brand can lose its relevance. A competitor can theoretically engineer a product so vastly superior that consumers are suddenly willing to endure the friction of switching costs.
So what is the apex?
The apex of this hierarchy is the infrastructural moat. It exists in a different paradigm entirely. We're talking about regulatory duopolies, proprietary global payment rails, or indices that are legally embedded into the mandates of trillions of dollars in passive retirement funds.
So it's not just a good product.
Exactly. These advantages are not sustained by a charismatic executive team or an aggressive marketing budget. They are forged by the structural design of the market itself.
They are the digital highways of capitalism. I mean, you cannot simply decide to pave a competing highway right next to the only existing one that crosses the continent, especially when every business in the world has already built their loading docks to align with the first one.
That is it exactly. Because the market structure mandates their existence, no single act of traditional competition can replicate or dismantle them. This dominance guarantees the purity of the long-duration wave. When a moat is truly infrastructural, the zero-cost growth it captures becomes practically permanent.
Okay, so identifying an infrastructural toll position is one thing, but establishing what it is actually worth requires a completely different vocabulary. The article introduces four specific valuation concepts: the floor, the gap, the gift, and the guarantee.
Let's start with the floor.
Okay.
The floor establishes the absolute minimum intrinsic value of the enterprise. You calculate this by looking exclusively at its current free cash flow and treating it as a zero growth perpetuity.
Meaning you calculate its value, assuming it simply generates the exact same amount of cash it does today every single year until the end of time without ever growing by a single cent.
A severe assumption of zero future growth. But it provides a baseline.
Right.
Then we have the gap. The gap is the distance between that calculated floor and the current market price of the stock. When the market price drops below the zero growth floor, you are looking at Benjamin Graham's foundational concept of a margin of safety.
So you are purchasing a structurally protected cash flow stream for less than its absolute minimum calculable worth. If the downside is mathematically protected by that floor, the upside dynamics must be where the asymmetric returns are generated.
Yes, and that is the function of the free growth premium. We established the floor assuming absolutely zero growth, but the free surfer, due to its architecture, naturally generates that 10 to 15% annualized zero cost growth.
Right, the wave.
Because the asset was acquired at or below the zero growth floor, every percentage point of that future expansion is acquired for free. It was deliberately excluded from the purchase price.
The most valuable growth an investor can acquire is the growth they do not pay for. You secure an expanding economic engine for the price of a stagnant one.
Precisely.
And the final concept, the guarantee, addresses how that value is ultimately realized, right?
The guarantee relies on Charlie Munger's principle of convergence. Over a sufficiently long timeline, the return a publicly traded stock provides will mathematically converge with the underlying return the business earns on its own capital.
Reality eventually forces the market's hand, and the specific mechanisms forcing that convergence are dividends and share buybacks. The dividend acts as an immediate quarterly audit. It proves the cash flow is real and unmanipulated. But the buyback is the actual engine of convergence, isn't it?
It is. By continuously deploying that massive free cash flow to reduce the overall share count, the business forcefully pushes the per share value upward toward its true intrinsic worth.
It mechanically shrinks the denominator.
Right. The market eventually has no choice but to recognize the concentrated value.
I want to address a claim in the text that seems deeply counterintuitive. It argues that Wall Street analysts apply a standard discount rate, a risk premium, to these businesses when modeling their future cash flows. But the author insists these specific businesses actually carry a negative risk premium.
It sounds strange at first.
A negative risk premium sounds like an oxymoron. I mean, Wall Street exists to price risk. How can a publicly traded equity be considered less risky than the baseline standard?
Well, consider the fundamental purpose of a risk premium. It exists to discount the present value of future cash flows based on the uncertainty that those flows will actually materialize.
Right.
A standard manufacturing or technology business faces relentless competitive erosion, shifting consumer behavior, and the constant threat of technological obsolescence.
Boom.
The probability of them generating cash in 10 years is highly uncertain.
Therefore, you apply a heavy discount rate to their projected future value.
The free surfer operates under completely different physical laws. It is guarded by an infrastructural moat. Its growth arises at zero marginal cost. It is virtually immune to the competitive erosion that plagues standard equities.
So the certainty of its future cash flows is higher than nearly any other commercial entity.
Exactly. Applying a standard discount rate to that level of certainty is an analytical failure. The asset warrants a preferential, significantly lower discount rate.
Meaning the true intrinsic value, the actual floor, is significantly higher than standard models are capable of calculating. The market fundamentally misprices the absence of risk.
The market penalizes the free surfer for lacking a daily narrative, completely failing to realize that the absence of drama is the exact characteristic that guarantees the permanence of the cash flow.
Okay, but if these businesses are architecturally superior and mathematically mispriced, why does the market ever let them go on sale? How do interest rates play into this? Why would the price ever drop below that floor in the first place?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it centers entirely on the cost of capital. During prolonged periods of macroeconomic exuberance, when central banks hold interest rates near zero and capital is virtually free, the fundamental gradient between a fragile mechanical business and a robust free surfer is completely obscured.
So when money is cheap, every business looks like it's compounding. It is like finding out the loudest, flashiest player at the poker table is betting entirely with a high-interest loan. While the chips are flowing, the illusion is perfect.
Yeah.
A mechanical business can borrow billions of dollars to mask its structural inefficiencies, acquire artificial growth, and generate a spectacular, highly visible narrative for the market.
Cheap money is the ultimate camouflage. During these periods, institutional attention rotates entirely toward the visible spectacle. Capital chases the heavily leveraged, high-growth narratives.
And the free surfer is sidelined.
Its valuation multiples compress. Not because the underlying architecture has faltered, the business continues to quietly capture its toll, but simply because the market is distracted.
So the market isn't actively rejecting the free surfer based on negative fundamentals. It is simply forgetting it exists amid the noise.
But the macroeconomic tide inevitably turns. Interest rates normalize, the cost of capital rises, and suddenly the camouflage is violently stripped away.
And the mechanical businesses that relied on borrowed capital to fund their expansion begin to fracture. Their profit margins collapse under the dual weight of servicing expensive debt and rising input costs.
The visual metaphor used in the article is striking here.
The beach houses.
Yes. The heavily leveraged mechanical businesses are the glass beach houses built right on the sand. During low tide, they look spectacular. The free surfer is the unremarkable stone fortress built far back on the cliff.
So when the tide violently comes in, the beach houses are swept away, while the toll position remains entirely untouched by the water.
That destruction triggers what the article calls the compression harvest.
The compression harvest.
The market, operating out of sudden terror and necessity, suddenly remembers the safety of the infrastructure. Capital flees the collapsing narratives and rushes back to the absolute certainty of the pure moat. The valuation multiples forcefully expand, snapping back to align with the reality of the architecture.
And the text is explicitly clear that this is not a short-term trading strategy. Attempting to time the macroeconomic cycles or predict exactly when the market will shift its attention is impossible.
No, the compression harvest is a structural transfer of wealth. It is the guaranteed inevitable movement of capital from the impatient investor who chased the ephemeral noise to the patient investor who recognized the infrastructure, secured a position, and simply waited.
So the ultimate lever activating every single mechanism we have, analyze the pricing power, the inflation pass-through, the margin of safety, the convergence of the buyback, is simply time.
Time is the singular variable that forces the architecture to yield its value.
The layers of the permanent wave stack exponentially over time. The gap between price and value closes over time.
Which leads directly to the final consideration the article leaves us with, drawing on Charlie Munger's perspective. The big money is not in the buying or the selling, but in the waiting.
Right.
This entire framework forces a rigorous examination of an investor's psychological disposition. It asks a deeply uncomfortable question. Are you deploying your intellectual energy and capital trying to predict the next loud, visible spectacle, the narrative that is statistically guaranteed to eventually burn out?
Or do you possess the psychological fortitude to identify a permanent infrastructural toll, secure a position, and then do absolutely nothing, recognizing that within this specific architecture, silence and inaction are the most productive uses of capital? Visit averagingup.com to explore the full collection.